Welcome to The Ralph Report with Ralph Garman.
Hey there, boys and girls. Welcome to The Ralph Report for a Thursday. It is April 12th, and it's almost the end of the week. Hang in there. One more day, and then we get the weekend. I'm ready for it. How about you? I've been, as you know, traveling this week. Went to Cleveland for a quick turnaround to do Hollywood Babylon with my buddy Kevin Smith. And I'm ready to get some stuff done around the house, hang out around the house. We're also going to be in Brea, California, later on this weekend, Saturday night, doing Hollywood Babylon at the Improv in Brea. But that one is sold out, so thanks, everybody, in Brea, California. I'm just, I'm tired, and I'm upset from last night. Still upset from last night. I don't know if you are a hockey fan or not. I know some listeners out there will be following the NHL playoffs, which, in my opinion, best playoff in any professional sport. I'm a huge football fan. I love me some football, and I do enjoy the NFL playoffs, but you can't beat professional hockey for excitement in the playoffs, because even in football, you'll have some stinker games as you get towards the Super Bowl. Super Bowl itself is often awful, so you can't really count on it. But in hockey, you can almost always guarantee great series every step of the way. And my beloved Philadelphia Flyers are in the playoffs this year, which is the good news. They missed it last year. They're in it this year, though. That's the good news. The bad news is they're facing their dreaded rivals, the Pittsburgh Penguins, who, they're okay. I mean, they did win the Stanley Cup the past two seasons. Yeah, two-time defending champions. So that's not necessarily the team you want to face in the first round when you're trying to get your playoff legs underneath you. And you got a couple goalies that are pretty banged up. And last night, 7-0 was the final score. And it was not, the good guys did not come out on top. 7-0, the Philadelphia Flyers were pummeled by the Pittsburgh Penguins. And you know, you can usually count on playoff hockey to be pretty close, pretty tightly contested affairs. A lot of defense going back and forth. Sometimes goals are hard to come by. Yeah, not so much for the Penguins last night. But at least many of you there in the Garmy are aware of my love of the Flyers, and many of you are Pittsburgh Penguin fans, and at least you've been beating me up. So that makes me feel better with all the abuse I've been getting on Twitter and from other sources. However, not all of you are being rough with me. There's a few kind-hearted members of the Garmy out there who, even in their sort of celebration of what was a blowout last night, there was some kindness as well, like this caller.
Yeah, hey, Ralph. You know, Mom taught me it wasn't polite to gloat, so I'm just going to say this is going to be a good series, and the Flyers might pull it out in six. Who the hell knows? And if they do, I'll be rooting for them all the way, man. Love you. Mean it. Bye-bye.
And I appreciate that. I'm not sure about the Flyers maybe taking it in six. I'm not feeling confident, as you can imagine, after last night. But I appreciate your kindness, so that was very cool of you. Next game, was it Friday? Friday's the next game, yeah. So, look, I can't be too greedy with the sports gods this year after the Super Bowl. So I should probably just take what I can get and just be happy the Flyers are in it. So there you go. But thanks again for leaving that message on the Ralph Report hotline. You can always reach me there as well, 1-833-HI-RALPH, or you can write me at ralph@theralphreport.com. Good show coming up today. It is Thursday. That means Sex University is on tap, and we'll be talking about, of all the sort of the interesting permutations that sexual and romantic relationships can take. This one is probably the most confusing to some people, and perhaps the least understood and least known. It's called polyamory. We'll be talking about that today. Taylor Williamson is still on the show this week. We'll be talking more about his life on America's Got Talent, when that sort of made him as a comedian, and what his life was like during that show and then after that show. As you can imagine, big difference in his career and personal life. But let's kick things off the way we do here on The Ralph Report with taking a look at all the entertainment news. And you may have heard the rumor like I did that Jake Gyllenhaal was being considered to be the next Batman. Well, looks like he has shot down that rumor. Gyllenhaal was doing an interview and was asked about sporting Batman's cape and cowl, and he said, "Wow, that's a very difficult question." And the answer to that question is no. So I don't know why it's so difficult. Apparently it was pretty easy for him to answer. He looks like he will not be the Batman in the new Batman movie called The Batman, directed by Matt Reeves. This is the one that was supposed to be Ben Affleck. Affleck worked on the script. He was supposed to direct, and then he backed out from directing. And it sounds like he's backing out from playing the Batman, and Matt Reeves doesn't necessarily want him. Sounds like Reeves wants to reboot the character, so still no word on what's happening with the character, but things seem to be a little bit of a mess over there at the DC Comics movies, so we may not know for some time exactly what's going on. In casting news, Sacha Baron Cohen is starring in a new Netflix drama series called The Spy. I know you wouldn't necessarily think of Sacha Baron Cohen in a drama, but he will be starring as in the role of Eli Cohen, who was a spy for Israel in Syria during the early 1960s. This is a 6-episode series that is set in that time based on this true story. And he worked his way high up into Syrian society and through the ranks of their politics. And the whole time he was working for Israel. So even though this is a period piece, it certainly is relevant for today's political situation as well. Sacha Baron Cohen, I think, is going to be great as a dramatic actor. I've always said that if you can play comedy, and he certainly can, and he's a chameleon, he can change characters so completely and so believably. If you can do comedy, you can do drama. And, of course, Jim Carrey is the exception that proves that rule. This is an interesting survey done by a group called YouGov.com, and apparently that's all they do, is these surveys. But they took 20 men and 20 women, high-profile celebrity men and women, put them in a poll, and then polled 37,000 people in 35 different countries around the world to find out who the most admired people in the world are. I think you'll be surprised by the results. The number one most admired man in the world? Bill Gates. Well, I guess that's not too surprising. Rich, powerful, an innovator. I can see why people would admire him. And for women, Angelina Jolie was the most admired woman in the world. Beautiful, talented, altruistic, does a lot of charity work. I can see why she would be admired around the world. Both Jolie and Gates have topped the lists now for 3 years in a row. Following Bill Gates around the world, President Barack Obama was second in terms of most admired. Then actor Jackie Chan, President Xi of China, and Chinese business magnate Jack Ma rounded out the top five worldwide. After Angelina Jolie, it's First Lady Michelle Obama, TV show host Oprah Winfrey, Queen Elizabeth II, and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Now, when you get to the results from the United States, here's where it gets really interesting. The most admired man in the U.S., Barack Obama, with 24% at number one. Then second, Donald Trump, 10.7%. Isn't that just indicative of what our country is going through right now? That one in two most admired men in the U.S. are Barack Obama and Donald Trump. Could you find two bigger opposites in their appeal? Number three was Billy Graham, the late preacher. Pope Francis was fourth. Bill Gates was only fifth in the U.S. Dwayne Johnson was number six. Clint Eastwood came in at number seven. Bernie Sanders, the Dalai Lama, and Elon Musk were the most admired men here in the United States. The top 10 most admired women, Michelle Obama was number one, then Oprah Winfrey, Queen Elizabeth II. Hillary Clinton was fourth. Ellen DeGeneres was fifth. Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Condoleezza Rice was number seven. I find that surprising in the sense that she hasn't been very high profile here in the States in a long time. So number seven. And number nine is also surprising. Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the ninth most admired woman in the United States. She's a dumpster fire. Let's face it, she's not even good at what she does. And often what she does is lie. That's just the truth. So if you're admiring her, I think you need to reassess. That would be my opinion. And this is why it's the happiest place on earth. This is great. Federal authorities in Atlanta say they seized 500 pounds of meth that were concealed inside Disney character figurines. That's why it's the happiest place on earth. These ceramic figurines were filled with meth. They were shaped like characters, including Pluto, Daisy Duck, Winnie the Pooh, Piglet. That's an age-old smuggling technique. You stuff the drugs inside these little figurines, and the estimated street value is about $2 million. No word on when or how they found out about the meth inside these statues. I bet the guys shipping them were acting a little goofy. Zing! Let's take a look at who was born on this day, April 12th. All these celebrities born. Herbie Hancock, jazz musician Herbie Hancock, 78 years old today. Remember Rocket? Remember that song Rocket? That video used to freak me out. All those robots walking around just legs and kicking and stuff and everything. Give me a little Rocket. Yeah, check out that video. It's still weird. Creeped me out back in the 80s. John Kay of Steppenwolf is 74 years old today. Ed O'Neill from Modern Family. And of course, Married with Children, 72. Dan Lauria from Wonder Years is 71, as is David Letterman. Andy Garcia, one of my favorite actors. So good in The Untouchables. I was blown away by him in that role. 62 years old. Nicholas Brendon from Buffy the Vampire Slayer is 47, as is my friend Shannon Doherty. She's 47 years old today. Guy Berryman of Coldplay turns 40. Actress Claire Danes is 39. Jennifer Morrison, actress from Once Upon a Time and also House, is 39 as well. And Saoirse Ronan is 24 years old today. So happy birthday to you, Saoirse. Oh, Erin Cobra. That's our new character, the birthday leprechaun. I'm Ralph Garman, and I walk the showbiz beat. Well, it is a Thursday, and as you know, every Thursday we have a standing date here at Ralph Sex University, where we open up our classroom doors and we teach you a little something about what people are doing behind closed doors. Here is today's Ralph Sex U.
You don't know what to do. There's one man to help you through. He's a graduate of Sex U. Some are come loudly.
And today we are talking about polyamory. And the reason we're talking about that is because I got an email from a member of the Garmy named Laura who sent in this. The main reason I'm writing is because one of the women you interviewed on your Sex U segment on bisexuality, which I loved, mentioned polyamory. And I wondered if that's something you would consider discussing on Sex U. Polyamory is probably even less known and understood by the mainstream than bisexuality, and I think it would be great to spread some awareness. I'd be happy to talk to you about it. Thanks for reading and all your hard work, Laura. And I thought that's a great idea because I was aware, to a certain extent, about polyamory, but it is a complex and confusing sometimes lifestyle to people who aren't familiar with it. It seems like swinging, people can understand that. A couple goes to a party, whatever, has casual sex with other partners to spice up their sex life. They can wrap their heads around that. Bisexuality, of course, people can understand being attracted to both sexes. It's fairly common, and many people have even experimented with it themselves. But the polyamory is unique in the sense that it is not about recreational sex. It is not about simply spicing your life up with bringing strangers into the bedroom. This is a complex social and romantic situation where more than one person is involved in a romantic relationship with others. If that makes any sense, imagine a V, and at the bottom of the V, the point of the V, there is someone who is involved with someone else, and that goes up to the right, and then another relationship that goes up to the left. So there you have like a three-way relationship, but everyone is completely on board with that relationship. And then there's permutations from there. It doesn't have to be three people. It can be four. It can be five. And these are loving, intimate, long-term relationships with more than one person. It is called sometimes ethical non-monogamy. And often when you think of polygamy, you think of like on HBO's Big Love. You think of religious cultists, you know, the Mormons, certain sects of the Mormons have one husband and many wives and the sister wives. And it used to be the domain of the hippies on communes and things like that, where they would have multiple partners working together. But those days are gone. This is a very mainstream lifestyle now. It is, it's all over the world, here in the States as well as abroad. And I thought the best way to get a handle on it, to truly understand how someone can be in a relationship with more than one person, and that's their preferable way to express themselves when it comes to sex and love, we would talk to Laura herself about her history and her preference to be in multiple relationships with multiple people at the same time. Here is my conversation with Laura. Laura, thank you so much for spending some time with me today to talk about polyamory, which is something I'm guessing a lot of people have at least a little confusion about.
Yeah, if they've even heard the word, which many people probably haven't.
Well, you know, it's pretty new. It just started being used in the 90s. I did a little research, and until then, yeah, it was called things like complex marriages and things like that. But polyamory is different from swinging and things like that in the sense that this is a full-blown romantic relationship involving more than two people, right?
That's right. You know, someone could be polyamorous and have casual sex or a friends with benefits situation, of course. But yeah, it's polyamory if there is at least an option of, okay, we may be dating more than one person at a time.
Now, are you dating more than one person together, or is it an open relationship where each person in the relationship is also dating other people? Does that make sense?
Yes, it does make sense. It really depends on the people involved. You know, if you're part of a couple that chooses to be polyamorous, you might say, well, we only want to date people that both of us are dating. But I think I've more commonly seen it that it's just the relationship is open. And, you know, because especially if you have a couple that's heterosexual and both partners are heterosexual, there's not going to be anyone they want to date together, but they may still, you know, the woman might want to date other men and the man might want to date other women.
So how is polyamory then different from, let's say, swinging or an open marriage or relationship?
It would really be the fact that you can have a romantic aspect as well. You know, I think with swinging, it tends to be sex only, you know, casual sex. Mm-hmm. And with polyamory, you could end up dating, you could end up, you know, you couldn't do this legally, but you could even end up marrying more than one person. You know, people sometimes end up in triads and they find ways to be together. I think I've heard about people like incorporating, like they were a business so that they can share assets the way a married couple would. Things like that. It doesn't necessarily get that extreme, but it's a romantic relationship, not just a sexual one.
And for those unfamiliar with the term, can you please explain triad for everybody?
Oh, yes. Triad would be three people who are all dating each other.
Right. And usually, I think in most cases, it's a man and two women, because women tend to be more sort of open with their bisexuality. But
sure.
That seems to be a common formation when it comes to polyamory. Now, what's your personal experience with polyamory, Laura? Have you been in polyamorous relationships?
Yes. I recently briefly dated a man who was married, and he and his wife were poly. That was just kind of a casual thing that didn't last that long. But a while back, I was in a triad with a couple who were married at the time, and actually lived with them for a couple of years. And yeah, it was, you know, it was a normal relationship really, but there were three of us.
So I'm assuming that you are bisexual?
Yeah, sexuality is funny. These days I kind of tend to identify as heteroflexible, but obviously I have, you know, attraction to women in me, or I wouldn't have dated a woman for several years.
Right. A lot of people, when they think of polyamory, think of like that HBO series Big Love, like the Mormons, where there's a guy with a bunch of wives and situations like that. What was your living situation like when you were living with that couple in a triad? Did you all share the same house, the same facilities, all that?
Yeah, we shared an apartment, and they had a bedroom where they slept, and I had my own bedroom because, honestly, because I like my space and I like to sleep alone. So, you know, I did occasionally sleep with them, but I just kind of prefer to sleep solo most of the time. So that was what we did, but other people have different situations. People invest in king size beds and all cuddle up together. I'm sure people who live together might have different rooms, but, you know, spend time in each other's beds more frequently than I really did. But we rented an apartment together. We shared housework. You know, they were married, so they had a merged bank account. I didn't have a merged, you know, bank account with them, but we all split the rent and the utilities and everything.
How did it work socially? Were you guys open with your triad to friends and family? Did people know what your relationship was?
Yeah, for the most part. You know, you don't necessarily want to get into it with casual acquaintances or work acquaintances unless they actually become friends, because it's so out of the mainstream that it kind of invites gossip, and you don't necessarily want to have to go around and educate everyone all the time.
Right.
But, you know, but with my family, with my close friends, we were very open. Everyone knew.
Now, did you have any issues with jealousy? I've heard that even in the most solid polyamorous relationships, occasionally there will be some bouts of jealousy that flare up.
Yeah, absolutely. I think jealousy is a normal human emotion. It's just dealt with differently in polyamory. I feel like polyamorous people, we view, if someone gets jealous, you view it as, all right, you know, the person that you're jealous of, this relationship needs some special attention because they're feeling insecure for some reason, rather than you shouldn't be interested in other people.
Right. How did the relationship end? You said you guys were together for a couple years. What was the downfall of the relationship? Was it just organic? You guys kind of grew apart, or was there a major issue?
Yeah, no, it was just, I was in my early 20s and, you know, still finding myself a lot. And I came to a place where I realized I no longer wanted to be in a romantic relationship with them, and had to end it, which was sad, but it worked out pretty well. I'm still friendly with both of them. I'm very good friends with the woman still. And so it could have been, you know, breakups are never fun, but it could have been a lot worse. And it certainly had nothing to do with being poly. I think a lot of people assume that if a poly relationship breaks up, it's because it was poly. But if a monogamous relationship breaks up, no one says, oh, well, it's probably because you guys were monogamous, right? Like there's other things that go on.
Although many relationships do end because people are forced to be monogamous. So
yeah. Well, I don't like to proselytize, but sometimes I think polyamory makes more sense. But a lot of people just aren't wired that way. It just wouldn't work for them. So
how did you first get involved? Was polyamory something you were interested in before this couple, or was it in meeting this couple that they opened you up to the idea of it?
No, I was actually kind of always polyamorous long before I learned there was a word for it. My earliest relevant memory is reading a book when I was probably in middle school. And there was a sort of a love triangle in it. I remember thinking, why can't she just be with both of them? And then, you know, many years later on the early days of the internet, I stumbled across the word polyamory and I was like, there's a name for this. There's other people who think that, you know, monogamy doesn't have to be the default. So when I got a little older and started dating, I always went out with the intention of finding other people who might be interested in polyamory.
And so I think it's safe to say that you identify as polyamorous. This wasn't a situational circumstance because of the couple. This is how you identify, and this is what you look for in relationships moving forward as well, right?
Yes. You know, as I've gotten older, there are definitely time constraints and energy constraints, which make me think, with the right person, maybe I would have a discussion about something a little more like monogamy. But my preference would definitely always be to have the door open for the possibility of something outside of that, if that was something that one or both of us felt we needed.
Are you in a relationship now, Laura?
No, not at the moment.
Does it make the pool you have to choose from when it comes to dating smaller, because this is where your interests lie? I mean, I can imagine if you were just on a first date with someone and you brought this up to some people, it might seem out of the ordinary and scare them off, for lack of a better word.
Yes, definitely. I've mostly done a lot of online dating, and I always put it on my profile, you know, I'm polyamorous or at least interested in non-monogamy. If that's a hard deal breaker for you, then we probably won't be a great match. It does make it smaller. I'm lucky. I live in the Boston area and there's a pretty big polyamorous community around here. Relatively big to other places. I think it definitely can limit you, but I kind of think that my generation and younger people, that this is going to become, some form of non-monogamy is going to become more common, the same way that gender is being looked at more fluidly and sexuality is being looked at more fluidly. I think people are going to start taking a look at whether monogamy is what they necessarily want.
Well, Laura, you are so eloquent in this area, and I really appreciate you sharing your experiences and your opinions about this stuff. And I think you gave a lot of people who are listening something to think about when it comes to their own relationships as well. So thanks for spending some time with me today.
Thank you. Happy to talk to you.
Thanks again to Laura for talking today about her experiences with polyamory. It's funny, when you talk to the experts, people fall down on both sides of this issue. Some say you are battling human nature by trying to confine yourself to one person throughout your lifetime. They say that is not natural for people to be monogamous. Others say by the fact that we are hardwired to be jealous and to want to keep what's ours, that shows that it is more natural to work at one relationship and maintain it for yourself. I think what really it comes down to is it's whatever works for you. Some people are miserable being with one person, and they need to have multiple relationships in order to feel fulfilled. Others don't have the time, energy, or inclination to want to have multiple romantic relationships. They want to be with one person who really fulfills them. The point is, whatever works for you, it's okay. Make your choice and do what makes you happy. That is today's Sex University. And before we say goodbye on this Thursday, we have time for another chapter of my interview with my friend, comedian Taylor Williamson, who was the runner-up on America's Got Talent, and that television show changed his life and career significantly, as you can imagine. He was at the lowest point of his career before he went on that show, and it led to the highest point. Today we talk about what it was like to be on the show, more importantly, what it was like after the show for him, and also about the state of comedy and television just in general. Taylor and I have both been going through some changes in terms of our careers and meeting with a lot of people, and it seems like there's a lot of confusion in show business these days, especially with network television and terrestrial radio and those traditional media forms are really starting to struggle. We talk a little bit about that in today's interview with Taylor Williamson. So you're on the show and you start to get, I guess, was it Mandel? Who was your champion on that show? Stern liked you too, right? Both of those.
Howard Stern and Howie were super awesome.
Yeah. And Heidi, not so much. I mean, what was the weird, you guys had a very dysfunctional sort of relationship on the show that they started to play up and made into a thing. But by the end of it, apparently you guys hit it off, right? Because didn't she say some like not nice things about you at one point during the process?
Yeah, like the first, if you go to taylorwilliamson.com, I have all my videos from my America's Got Talent journey in case anyone is curious to see.
You should. It's interesting just to watch the progression, I think, beside the fact that, again, all kidding aside, Taylor is very funny.
Thank you.
But I think I found it an interesting process just to watch how that show progresses and what happens and how the stakes keep getting higher and higher. I would think it would be so much easier early on. By the end, you must have been really frantic because you've got a chance to win, you know, first of all, first place, which there's a cash thing involved too, right?
You get like $1 million with an asterisk next to it.
But also career-wise, it could be a big door opener, and it was. We'll cover that. But so she said what to you at one point in the show?
So like, my first audition went well. The second one, there was like no audience, just the four judges in front of no audience. But that's actually my dream. Like, I'm so used to performing for no people, honestly. So like, I have a whole shtick that I do already when there's no crowd. So I'm just like, so I just went. So the first, I'm so lucky I didn't have to go up first because. So the first round is the audition when they're like, okay, you're going to the next round. Then a lawyer comes up to you and says, just so you know, you might not be going to the next round.
Right, right, right.
And then the next round is Vegas where they bring everybody out. And then so they had the comedians perform in a group. And the first comedian went out and he just performed his set like a robot. He made a simple mistake that anyone could have made where there's no one's laughing. So I'm just going to read off my jokes like I'm doing a monologue.
Oh, wow.
And it falls flat. It was really hard. It was difficult for everybody. But I was like, fuck this. It's not live. The cameras are going to keep rolling. There's no buzzer. Like, last Comic Standing, they cut off your mic if you go too long on the tape show even. So I was like, fuck it. So I went out there, did exactly what I do when I perform for four people. Wow, guys, this is horrible. This is, like, the worst moment of my life, and this is really bad. So I just played it off like, please, you guys, this is, come on, please. And I did a joke, and it worked. And I'm like, oh, cool. And then it didn't work. I'm like, you guys, come on, like, whatever.
That's funny.
So then the next round was the live show at Radio City Music Hall. And then I had a joke that I did in Last Comic Standing. That was a dilemma in my head, too. I'm like, my comedic pride. I'm like, I've already done this joke on TV. Should I not do it?
Can I recycle material or not?
Then I'm like, fuck the world. I'm trying to get out, have a career, and win a competition, or get far in a competition. And like, fuck anyone who's like, says I saw that clip from 3 years ago. You know?
Wait a minute.
But on NBC, the same time channel, I had a joke where I said condom, but they wouldn't let me say condom at the last minute on America's Got Talent, which is the same channel, the same time slot.
How strange.
So they're like, you can say prophylactic, which makes the joke sound filthier and like not funnier. Anyway, so that was the whole thing. And then I did the joke, and then I said something about blind people too. I don't know. Some pun, like good thing about dating a blind girl, you have to worry that she might be seeing other people.
Oh my lord.
Classic, you know? So I don't know. It was either the blind people joke or the condom joke. But then
Heidi took offense.
The judges liked me, but then Heidi was like, you're not an act that I could take to see my kids, and you're offensive or whatever. And I was terrified. And like, it's live, and like, I'm used to getting heckled and stuff. And like, my brain goes to, like, as a Jewish guy, if a German lady goes criticizes my comedy, there's so many levels you can go to. Like, there was a guy who does a Rube Goldberg machine, and she's like, I've never heard of a Rube Goldberg machine. I'm like, I want to be like, you know what happened to all the Goldbergs? You know, I had so many things I wanted to say, but I was like, I was so calculated. I knew it's better to be not funny and smile than to be mean funny.
Right.
So I just smiled.
Can't lose America.
For real.
Yeah.
But then the next round, and also the crowd booed when she didn't like me. And then looking back, that helped me because
then you're the victim.
I'm the victim, and there's something to rally behind. Like, there's people, there's great comedians who have been on that show, and they get a standing ovation. Every judge is like, you're great, you're great, you're great. They don't get voted through.
Yeah.
People like controversy. Mm-hmm. Or I'm going to vote to prove her wrong. No, it's people like that, whatever, the drama.
Drama, yeah.
So the next round, I did a whole act of, like, tongue-in-cheek kid-friendly jokes for Heidi Klum, but they were all like filthy sex jokes. But like, it was like, Heidi, you went to the zoo. You ever go to the zoo? I saw this camel had really tiny humps. Hope she has a nice personality, right? You know? And so it's just like stuff like that. And then that gave me my career. That's when I met you.
Yeah.
And that's when you had me on your other show. It was just meant the world to me. That meant so much to me, by the way, dude. And like I've been a fan of you for years. And like,
well, that's very kind of you to say. But once I started, a mutual friend of ours, Gabby Zamora,
yeah,
said, "Are you watching my friend Taylor on America's Got Talent?" And I said, "Is he the comedian? He's the Nebbish?" And she said, "Yeah." I said, "I didn't know you knew him. I think he's hysterical." And she said, "You should have him on the radio." And so, yeah, that's when we got you on the radio show.
Shout out to Gabby. I love her.
Yeah, I love her too.
But yeah, like, and that act gave me a career. And like, I mean, and the producers even said to me, they're like, "You can say these jokes you want to say. Like, we don't have a problem with it, but we don't think it's in your best interest to." Like, standard of practice says okay.
Right.
But career, voting wise, it might not be smart, but we can't tell you what to do. It and I decided, like, I can be vanilla and just try to get
skate
by
through.
I really, like, there's a big thought in my head where I was like, I want to go out swinging. I'd rather have that killer tape of look what I did on TV, I'm really proud of this set, than just squeak through and be fine and no one remembers him at the end, you know?
Right, sure.
But yeah, the hard thing about the show is you have to be better than you were the last time every time, but then do that again.
Yeah, right.
So how do you do the best save you ever had in your life every time? And it's not possible. Like, no. The next round, I don't feel like I did that. The finals, I ended up doing that out of desperation. But yeah, the show changed my life. Like, I've been coasting on that for 4 years, you know?
What was it like when you came in second? Did you think you were going to win?
I always
wonder in those competition shows what your feelings are when it's coming down to the final thing.
Anyone who goes on these shows thinking they're going to win is a fucking idiot.
Why?
I went on the show hoping to get on 2 episodes so I could kick colleges again, you know?
Yeah. Like, get some fresh tape.
For real. Like, as a comedian, like, I got tape. Yeah, exactly. Get a tape and then I'm going to pay my bills, you know? And
So that's your intention when you get on. But when you keep going and going and going and succeeding, and then it's down to 2 people.
The only reason...
At what stage, you know, do you start saying, holy shit, I might be able to pull this off?
The only reason I thought I might actually win was after the finals went dream come true level. Thanks. But like, it was like, it wasn't even, I don't even have a career based on my performances. It was the improvising with the judges afterwards. Like, I wrote lines at the beginning, but then the judges were like, "We like when you improvise with the judges. We're going to give you 2 minutes of extra. We're going to give you time to improvise with the judges afterwards." I was like, "No, I'm not clever. That was all pre-planned." Like, I would have a line every time Nick Cannon would say, I would say, "Hey, Nick, can you just ask me like how you think the show went or anything you want to say?" I would like have a joke prepared.
Right.
Like, one was like, I like saying things that are like TV edgy, like, "I can't believe you said that," but they can't get mad at me.
Yeah.
Like, I said to "You got through, how do you feel?" And I was like, I just want to say, this is a big deal for me. Like, Howie Mandel, I grew up watching you. Howard Stern, I grew up listening to you. And Heidi, I grew up doing weird things to you I can't talk about on TV. And like, but then like the final, so then I they kept, anyways, improvising was a big deal for me. And like, it was fear. It was all out of fear. I was just like, I can't, I'm going to bomb on TV.
Right.
And I just
sink or swim.
The fear is why I have a career, just being so scared of that. And, what am I talking? Oh, then the reason I thought I might win is there was this shady website that monitored the Twitter analytics of the votes. So you could vote on phone and on Facebook and on Twitter. So it could only monitor Twitter hashtags because that's the only thing that's like public.
Right.
So they were correct about who went through every round.
Oh, they would give projections about the predictions who was going to win.
Based on the Twitter votes, this is who's going through. And they were, every time they were 100% right. So I got the most Twitter votes that night. And I was like talking to my cousin. I was like, am I going to win this fucking thing? So then when it got to the final two, I was like, this is just the weirdest thing. And then I started worrying, what if I do win? And like,
why would you worry about that?
Because like, I mean, honestly, like if I would be, it's the pressure. Like, I would be scared of like, oh, you like, there's a lot of winners who never do anything.
Yeah,
a lot of them.
That's true.
And like, what if I'm like, sometimes you do a show and there's not a great turnout. Like, you do Thursday through Sunday. Sometimes the Thursday show sucks or Sunday show sucks or all the shows suck. I would just feel so much shame and guilt. And everyone's like, oh, that's the most talented man in America. Second place is funny. Underdog is funny.
That's true, I suppose. Yeah.
Winning is not funny. This is something I feel like Seinfeld would have this conversation with me. Like,
no, it's that's an excellent point, because you can always use that, especially if your act and your shtick is built around sort of being the loser,
yeah,
if you will. If you can come in and talk about how you lost, that just adds to your legend, really. You get to use that as a jumping off point. That's a good point.
Yeah, like, I mean, I don't know.
Plus, you lost to a Japanese guy, and you hate the Japanese. Right. We established that earlier tonight. No. You said that you called them monkeys. So it all now comes full circle.
I did not.
You're such a racist, and yet you lost to that race that you hate so much.
I myself was a monkey along with my Japanese friends.
Sure. That's
my amigos.
You're spinning it now.
Amigos.
That's not Japanese friend at all.
Do you know what it is? You want to learn something really fast?
Yes. And now that I didn't know you were fluent in Japanese.
So do you remember Tamagotchis?
Tamagotchis, the toy, the little toy, yeah, that was your little digital friend.
It was like egg friend.
Yes, right.
But it's because tamago means egg, and tomodachi means friend.
Tomodachi?
Tomodachi is friend. Hey! Oh, look at you. See? You speak Japanese.
Yes, I do, fluently.
But then I lost, and then I've worried
then
every moment.
Then you got launched into a career which was, if it was the shittiest level going into that show, coming out, it must have been the high point for you.
Come on back tomorrow when I wrap up my interview with Taylor. Also, we're going to be talking a little finance tomorrow. Talk about how you can invest your money and make a couple bucks saving for retirement. Or if you want just to make some money on the side, how to make your money work for you. We'll be talking to Patrick Green, who knows all about that kind of stuff. He's going to give us some advice. Of course, my UK correspondent, Steve Ashton, will be on hand because it is Friday. We like to check in with him before the weekend. New movies coming out in Cineplexes this weekend, so we'll take a look at those new movies with the Movie Beat. It's going to be a good one tomorrow. Come on back, won't you? I love you. I mean it. Bye.